proceed.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning, Mr. Manning.
I'm William Manning with the firm of Saul Ewing, and with me at council table are my partners Richard Forston and James Taylor.
Good morning.
Your Honors, Chase Alexa is a real estate development company formed for the sole purpose of developing a parcel of land that is 166 acres and for a residential community, single-family residential community known as Winterberry Woods. The Chase Alexa contracted for the purchase of the property in February of 2004. It did its initial engineering, and it took the first step that's required in the process in Kent County, and that is it arranged for and attended a preliminary conference with the planning staff on May 23, 2005. It submitted its application for preliminary plan approval on July 11, 2005. 2006, I'm sorry. Just prior to that, on June 13th, 2006, the ordinance that is the subject of this case was introduced. It was one of four ordinances that are referred to as the adequate public facility ordinances. And they essentially say that the developer of real estate must assure that facilities which were necessary to support the project will be paid for. And those facilities that the four ordinances tend to are water, schools, emergency services, and highways. And so these ordinances were introduced between the time of the Chase Alexa's preliminary conference, the first step in the process, and its second step, which was a preliminary plan application. At that moment in time, and this is a finding made by the court below and a finding which we do not challenge, we think that Chase Alexa had spent $254,000, $250,000, in things that the value of which would never be returned to it because of the final APFO, which is APFO roads. We think that the reliance damages are much higher than that, but all agree, including the court below, that if you take the amount of money that had been spent and which could not be recovered by Chase Alexa on that at that moment in time, which was the introduction of the four APFOs, that it was $250,000.
Can you explain for me, there's that A PFO relating to roads requires a traffic study and certain improvements if recommended by that study, is that essentially?
Yes, sir.
Now, I saw in the briefs that you also, your client also made application to DLDOT, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And did DLDOT do a traffic study?
No.
So DLDOT imposed requirements that your client has agreed to make or satisfied?
I don't think it got that far in the process, Your Honor. The application made to DLDOT, as I recall, was an entrance plan approval. It was not accompanied by a TIS, nor do we believe that any was required. And so, if I take Your Honor's question correctly, Chase Alexa could have gotten to the end of the process, could have had final approvals without any TIS being required, if we're correct, under county or state law.
How does the APFO relate to DLDOT's responsibility? If DLDOT says everything's fine and the county says no, it's not fine, what is there some kind of conflict there or a problem?
The county, DLDOT leaves, and this is a general statement, it applies in this case. There may be exceptions in other cases that don't matter to this. DLDOT leaves to the county that determination. DLDOT performs a consultative purpose function. If county law requires a TIS, DLDOT will review the TIS. And it will assist the applicant in scoping the TIS, and then it will react to the TIS, and it will say, your TIS shows us this, we believe, and it in the form of a recommendation to the county, we believe you should not approve this project unless the developer commits to the following traffic improvements. But the determination whether a TIS is necessary in the facts of this case are left to the county. And that's generally true.
Am I correct in assuming that although such a study was never conducted, it's apparent to everyone that there would be some major highway improvements required?
Yes, ma'am.
And without doing that work, there's some reasonable estimate of the magnitude of that work, the cost of it?
Our client clearly did believe that at the end of the road, if it had done the TIS, and it's
right.
not just a question of dollars spent to do the TIS and then the expenses of the improvements that would have been required by the TIS, there's also a time issue. In order to have a TIS done by the enactment of these ordinances, which was in March of 2007, we believe, and based on the experience of this applicant, that you would have had to begin the process by sitting down with DLDOT and having a scoping meeting, and then you go out and perform your TIS, which can take several months, and then your TIS goes to DLDOT and sits there while DLDOT gets to its pile of TISs that are on the desk of Bill Brockenbro. And that process can take well over a year. And so this applicant would have had, even though it had, we believe, and that's why we're here today, reason to believe that no TIS would have been required, it nevertheless, in order to get a definitive response to Your Honor's question, would have had to start doing a TIS, even though none was required, well in advance of the enactment of this ordinance, in advance even of the introduction of the ordinance.
Now, there's a companion case in the Superior Court dealing with the county's refusal to grant an exception. Is that
yes,
right?
Sir.
Has that been stayed, or is that ongoing?
It is ongoing. The court below asked, when it delivered the opinion, which we challenge here on appeal today, the court below asked whether that case was rendered moot. We had a dialogue with the court below, and all agreed that that case was not rendered moot, and so it is ongoing. Depending on the outcome of this case, that may be moot, and indeed, if that case were to reach a conclusion before this case did, it could render this case moot.
All right. So why shouldn't we wait for that case? I assume if that case has a result against your client, that we may see both cases eventually?
Yes. It could be that that case was decided in such a way that we believe the court below committed error, but it's obviously far too early to say that, and we don't expect it. But either case could be stayed in favor of the other.
Okay. Well, is that in a summary judgment phase? Has it been briefed?
Yes. Yeah, the briefing is underway.
And when will that be completed?
Help me here. Oral argument is scheduled at the end of February, and I can't predict when a decision will be rendered after the oral argument. I pointed out that the ordinances were introduced between the preliminary conference and the introduction of the application for preliminary plan approval because of a Kent County ordinance which we believe tells Chase Alexa that intervening legal changes didn't apply to its project. And the language is as follows. The 187.17 requires that every applicant, before it submit a preliminary application, have what is called a preliminary conference. That's step one in the process. It says you got to have a preliminary conference. And then it says, and this is 187.17D, a preliminary application must be submitted within 6 months or another preliminary conference will be required, and the project must meet all current standards. We believe, Your Honors, that a clear and unavoidable implication of that language is that so long as the applicant timely pursues its application, 6 months being timely, he or she will not be affected by intervening changes made to the zoning laws. And so the intervening introduction of the APFOs should not have mattered to Chase Alexa, and it should have been permitted to proceed to the ultimate approvals for its project. The court below, we believe, erroneously applied the following construction to that language. It essentially said that just because this section says that an applicant will be required to comply with intervening laws if he or she does not move quickly, that doesn't mean that the applicant will not have to comply with those intervening laws even if he or she does move quickly. In other words,
Mr. Manning, I want to make sure I understand of the arguments you're making in this appeal. With respect to this argument, if what you just stated is correct and this court agrees, that could be the basis for our decision.
Yes, sir.
And we would never address vested rights or estoppel.
That is correct.
We get the vested rights to the extent that argument doesn't prevail in the alternative.
That's correct.
And then we get beyond vested rights to estoppel only if you don't prevail in the
first two.
So it's a hierarchy of arguments in the alternative.
Yes, sir. And quite frankly, Your Honor, that's why I start with the statutory construction argument, because it seems to me that it's isolated, it's clean, and it's discreet, and it doesn't get to any of the interesting issues that are raised in the vested rights or equitable estoppel analysis. It seems to us that a reading of that section, which essentially says that 187.17d has no effect whatsoever, in other words, these consequences could be visited upon the applicant whether or not the applicant timely moved forward with an application for preliminary approval.
Well, now, although you didn't characterize it this way in your brief, it seems to me that your estoppel argument does relate to this first argument, because you're arguing for an interpretation of the statute that seems to have been supported by the statements from the president of the levy court and the statements from the county attorney.
Your Honor, that is exactly right. If you ask me, I believe that what council president, levy court president, I'm sorry, Burris, and what county attorney Townsend had in mind when they said, if you're in the process, you're not going to be affected by intervening legal changes, I think they had this statute in mind. And so it was a little bit surprising that Kent County ultimately took position. There's conversation in this case about the significance of the planning staff's silence when it delivered its formal report in response to the application for preliminary plan approval, and my opponent will argue that you can't read anything into silence. I believe that in this formal report on this plan, which was being rendered well after these APFOs were introduced, and everybody knew that there was a retroactive date to the date of introduction, the reason that the staff didn't say, by the way, if these ordinances are enacted, you've got to comply with them, is because they didn't at the time think so. They thought, consistent with Council President Burris, consistent with County Attorney Townsend, that 187.17d insulated this applicant from intervening changes. We think that the reading given to 187.17d by the county and by the lower court, well, frankly, it's a reading, if you found 10 reasonable men or women on the street outside the door, I don't think 10 of them would give you that reading. And we are the law disfavors readings of statutes that makes them ineffective and unimportant, surplusage. And that's what 187.17d becomes if you assume that intervening legal changes will apply to the applicant regardless of whether the applicant moves promptly on in the process. And even if, Your Honors, the reading given to this statute below is a fair reading, I think all have to concede that the reading that we are giving this statute is at least as fair a reading. I think it's the better reading, but then I'm biased. My point is, at best, we get to a point where we all conclude that this statute is ambiguous. It's not clear what it means. And if that's true, then I note that it's a zoning law, and under the Mergenthaler case, which was decided in 1972, I believe, this court made clear that if you're dealing with an ambiguous zoning law, it gets a reading which favors the landowner. And so even if I would have to concede, even if you ask me to concede for purposes of the argument that the reading given to this statute below was a fair reading, one of two fair readings, I still would say it's ambiguous, and therefore the landowner's construction, which is entirely fair, and I think the better reading should be embraced. Your Honor, I see that my...
Does the record reflect how detailed this preliminary conference, in fact, was in this case? I mean, was it just sort of, hi, how you doing, this is what we're planning to do, it's okay?
I think the record reflects that there was a sketch plan in place, and this conference took place over a design that the developer at great expense had obtained from its engineers, and that comments were made, which is the purpose of this conference. Observations, initial observations, were made by the planning staff, and that's why the rule exists, 187.17d. Get our comments, take them into account, get your plan application in within 6 months of that conference, hopefully a better application than the sketch plan you brought to the preliminary conference, and we'll protect you. In the intervening time, we will let you have the comfort of knowing that no changes, legal changes, would apply to your project.
Well, excuse me, when did you submit the preliminary application? I know you said May
205. I apologize. It was July. It was a month after the introduction of the APFO, so it was in July of 06.
Well, that's more than 6 months after the preliminary conference.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor, the preliminary conference was in May.
Of 2005 or 2006?
2006. I apologize
if
I misstated
fine.
That.
Okay.
It was less than 6 months.
If I understand the record, the preliminary plan application complied with all of the existing law. Although these ordinances had been introduced, they hadn't been enacted. And as your application went forward, there are even statements in the record that your application complied with all of the existing law.
Unquestionably true. It is undisputed that the staff delivered a formal report on the preliminary application saying, yes, this complies.
Well, you've got about 2.5 minutes. Do you want to save that for
if I may? Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Mr. Shannon.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, on behalf of the Kent County Levy Court and Kent County Regional Planning Commission, Scott Shannon.
Can I start with perhaps one of the conclusory arguments? Why doesn't this statute, 187.17d, what's the purpose of having language in there about it, how if you don't do it within 6 months, you've got to do it over again and comply with existing law? Why doesn't that kind of naturally read to mean that if you do it, you get the benefit of whatever the law was when you started the process?
It's a fair question, Your Honor, and the purpose of the preliminary conference is stated within 187.17c, and that purpose is to, if I can read, to assist the applicant by furnishing information and advice, expedite the application process for the applicant, save him unnecessary expense, so the applicant's not putting together a plan, not knowing whether or not it will be in an area zoned for the use of plants, et cetera, and promote the best coordination between the plans of the applicant and those of the Kent County Comprehensive Plan and other public agencies. And we believe that that language is critical, Your Honor, because nowhere within 187.17 is there any statement that the purpose of the preliminary conference is to determine the applicable zoning regulations. The language in 187.17a is that the purpose of these consultations, among other things, is to identify the zoning regulations and other requirements relating to or affecting the proposed subdivision. Now, it's a canon of statutory instruction that where different terms are used in different areas of the statute, the legislature is accepted to have intended a different meaning. The phrase applicable zoning regulations or applicable regulations is to be found nowhere within Chapter 187, Article 4, which is the preliminary conference, which includes 187.17, 18.19.
Aren't all those purposes frustrated by a new ordinance that essentially requires them to start over?
Not at all, Your Honor, because the purpose is not absolute coordination. The purpose is best coordination. And the county recognizes, the code recognizes, that this is a sketch plan conference. It is, here's a map, here's the parcel of land we want to put it on, we want to put a subdivision oriented this way with basically this layout of interior streets and these number of lots. That's why it's called a sketch plan. But the developer then takes that back and has to prepare a more detailed preliminary plan that provides all of the required information, names of streets, sizes of lots, open space, you know, all of the requirements under the zoning regulations.
Well, let's go back to Justice Berger's question. You keep talking about the conference. Her question relates to the preliminary plan. And the question is, if you submit the preliminary plan within 6 months of the conference, why don't you simply have to comply with the existing law if it provides a developer who goes beyond the 6 months has to comply with the existing law at the later period of time?
I understand, and the answer that I'm working towards hopefully answers, I'm aiming for the trifecta or the hat trick to answer both all three of the questions that are pending, which is the best coordination takes into account that there will be a lag between a sketch plan, concept plan, and the preparation of what is required for a preliminary plan. But during that time, additional zoning regulations may be adopted. So the first time...
Can I stop you right there?
Yes, Your Honor.
This new ordinance, when was it introduced? I mean, when did it first surface?
The original unitary version, it was an omnibus APFO that was not adopted, was originally introduced on November 29th of 2005.
Okay. And when did it become law?
That version was not adopted.
Well, whatever version.
It was withdrawn, and the four individual APFOs were introduced on June the 12th of 2006.
Right.
APFO for Central Water was the first that was adopted. It was adopted in September 17th, I believe it was, of 2006. The second one was APFO for Emergency Medical Services, which was adopted in October of 06. There was then the election cycle, the 06 election cycle. The new levy court was seated. It was four of the seven members were replaced, seated in January of 07. And the final two APFOs for roads and schools were adopted on March the 27th of 2007.
Okay. And I asked that because you're telling us that the way this statute should be read is to provide for coordination and the fact that, regulations could change, that's part of the coordination, and that's why the statute should not be read to fix one's obligations based upon the original law. But at the same time, what we've got here is something that took a year and a half to make its way through the legislative process. So we've got a situation where if we read the statute the way you suggest, a developer can just sort of have to float along because, today this is what the law says, but they're talking about another law. Well, I'm starting my project today. Yeah, but this other law could become law 6 months from now, 12 months from now, 18 months from now. And if it does, then you'll either have to stop your project or, redo it altogether so that it meets this new law. I mean, does that make sense in terms of coordination?
In terms of coordination, Your Honor, again, what the cited code section relates to is best coordination. Perfect coordination, we submit, is simply not possible. But there's two parties to this transaction. One is the county and one is the developer. We argued this below. It's part of our submissions below. We didn't address it within our pleading or the appeal briefs because the issue hadn't come up. But there were at least three, there might have been four off the top of my head, developments that went through the identical process and reached final plan approval between June the 12th of 2006 and March the 27th of 2007. As a matter of fact, there was one particular project, and it's in our briefing below, that was granted preliminary subdivision approval at the exact same date, at the exact same hearing as Chase Alexa. And they filed for final subdivision approval and got it the first week of March of 07. So it is possible for a developer, and that project was of similar size to what Chase Alexa has proposed.
So are you saying that Chase Alexa got punished because they were slower?
It's not a question of punishment at all, Your Honor. It's the levy court's ability. It's police powers authority granted under the Constitution. It's been repeatedly recognized to adopt a new, additional, different zoning regulations and enforce them at a point in time prior to rights having vested, sufficient progress along obtaining the regulatory approvals to say that the rights have vested. This is a recurring fact pattern. It's not punitive at all. The same opportunity that the other developers had, Chase Alexa had, as a matter of fact.
So if I understand what you're saying is that although, the law can be changing and not even finished being changed while you're trying to do a development, but other people managed to do it and come out with a project that's viable, so therefore that's not a problem.
Respectfully, Your Honor, the other side of that coin is the developer can say, I know you want to change the law, but I'm going to get my approvals done before you finalize your new ordinance.
How many developers, if any, does the record reflect how many developers, if any, are similarly situated to Chase Alexa? Is this one unique case, or is this a case that will establish a precedent for 10 other projects?
There were a total of, the numbers are off the top of my head, but they're fairly close. I believe there were some 50 projects in various stages of having obtained development approvals through this process, which sought APFO exemption hearings. 28 of those projects, I believe, were granted exemptions. The levy court looked at them and said, yes, you have gotten far enough along in the process. And many of those had obtained, for example, the state agency regulatory approvals required by 18724D, DelDOT, Kent Conservation District, State Fire Marshal. There were 22, as I recall, that were denied exemptions. And 18 of those filed challenges in Superior Court under 9 Delaware Code, Section 4818. Several of those have since brought their projects into compliance. Eight in total have been dismissed. There are some still pending. Chase Alexa had progressed the furthest along the regulatory pathway, but there are a certain number of the remaining 10 or 12 that had at least gone through the preliminary conference. So the court's decision would establish precedent, certainly as to those, but it would establish a larger precedent because it would afford the 18717D, it would elevate it to the status of a safe harbor provision. And the decision would be, so long as a developer has paid $250, submitted a sketch plan, then it doesn't matter what happens in the next 30 months. Whatever zoning regulations or zoning changes that come along, that developer would be exempt from any of those, having, again.
Are you calling the preliminary plan application a sketch plan?
No, Your Honor. The sketch plan is a defined term under 18717D for the preliminary
plan. But here we're talking about the preliminary plan application.
Respectfully, Your Honor, Chase Alexa's position is that the preliminary conference, the sketch plan, gives them that protection.
Well, then I've misunderstood their argument completely. I was under the impression their argument is that we have a preliminary conference, and if within 6 months we submit a preliminary plan application, then the law that exists when we submit our preliminary plan application is the law we have to comply with through the rest of the process.
That is their argument, Your Honor. That is their argument. But I'm...
Then maybe I misunderstood your characterization of their argument.
The mere submission of a sketch plan, which is not a preliminary plan, it's a sketch.
Well, tell me why we're talking about this sketch plan at all, because I'm under the impression our focus is on the preliminary plan application.
We believe the focus should be on the preliminary plan application, because that is the first step under code section.
You mean conference?
No, Your Honor, the application, the plan application.
Okay.
The preliminary application under section 187.20 is the first step in the process, where the phrase, the staff shall review the preliminary plan to determine the applicable zoning and other regulations.
Are you talking about now at the conference?
No, Your Honor. This is the preliminary plan application.
Okay.
I'm with you.
That's fine.
Yeah. This is what follows the preliminary conference. And I
understand. And it has to follow within 6 months.
Within 6 months.
Right. Okay.
That is correct.
So the staff decides what's going to apply. And according to what you just read, and the argument of the developer is, what applies is the law at the time I filed.
Our position, Your Honor, is that that determination by staff is made initially at the preliminary plan application stage under 187.20.
Right.
Because that language that I just read is 187.20D. But then it is reviewed anew at the final application stage, which is 187.24. In that language, the determination of the applicable zoning regulations is found at the preliminary application stage under 187.20. It's found again at the final application stage, 187.24.
So your position is the staff said here, this is the existing law, and these ordinances were in progress, as Justice Berger's question
yes.
indicated. And as the developer in this case, Chase Alexa, proceeded to comply with the existing law, the staff said, you've done it all, everything under the existing law you've complied with. But then these ordinances were passed. And it's your position that before they could get final approval, it was appropriate for the staff to say, I know you complied with all of the law at the time you submitted your preliminary plan application, but now, notwithstanding your compliance, we've had a change in the law, and before you get final approval, you have to comply with the new law.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That was stated. Not only are there distinct stages in the application process, and again, at preliminary, there's a determination of applicable regulations, and at final, there is a new determination of applicable regulations, but the APFOs themselves, in the applicability provision, which we quote at length in the brief, specifically states, any application that comes up for review or re-review by the Regional Planning Commission or the Levy Court. And that re-review is critical because there is a Regional Planning Commission review at the preliminary application stage, and there is a re-review at the final application stage. And the last step in the process is the Levy Court is required under 187.24D to make a positive determination of consistency with the applicable codes and regulations. That's the first time the Levy Court weighs in at the final stage. And there is nothing within the code which limits the Levy Court's or the Regional Planning Commission's ability to impose new or additional newly adopted regulations to plans which have not met the final, had not attained final approval.
Can I
go
off on a tangent here? So please indulge. Couldn't you, that is the Levy Court, set up an arrangement that says for the next 6 months we're not accepting applications because we are in the process of revising the regulations. So, you know, everybody be on notice, no applications, no process, nothing. Is that a feasible approach to the problem, if you will, of having development going forward while changes are being made in the zoning laws?
We tried that, Your Honor. There was a moratorium that was imposed. Your Honor may recall the panel that heard the appeal from potential court striking down the moratorium. Your Honor was a senior justice and was less than happy to have found out just before taking the bench that that there was a further litigation ongoing and a new moratorium, emergency moratorium, had been adopted. And the levy court attempted to do that. I related the election cycle in 06, the new levy court being sworn in January of 07, their first order of business was to adopt a moratorium. And that was the subject of that challenge. So they had attempted to do that. I don't know that it would have had an impact here on this case because there will always be projects at different steps in the regulatory approval process. And there are ways, for example, a grandfathering provision that says, you know, projects which have reached this stage in the process will not be this will not be applied, this ordinance. The option elected by the levy court in this instance was to state affirmatively that all applications for these approvals which have not attained final plan approval will need to bring their projects into compliance as a condition of final plan approval, and to give the developers the option of a exemption hearing to pursue. And again, from the county's position, we believe that that process worked very well.
And what was the basis for getting an exemption? What was the standard applied to determine that?
The standard that was applied is stated within the APFOs themselves. It bears a considerable relation to the legal, equitable articulation of vested rights and equitable estoppel. In other words, substantial reliance upon the pre-existing regulatory scheme change in position. It is stated within Section 7 of APFO Roads. It's the same language in all of them. But it was not an effort by the levy court to adjudicate constitutional rights, which the levy court recognizes is within the province of the courts. Was an exercise of the levy court's ability to determine whether to exempt an applicant from ordinances that they adopted.
Thank you.
My time is concluded. I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you.
With the brief time remaining, let me begin with an apology to Justice Berger. Despite your prodding, I still got the dates fouled up, and so let me clear up the record. The preliminary conference, which began the safe harbor created by 187.17d, was on March 25th of 06. These ordinances were introduced in June of 06, and by their terms became effective on that date once they were subsequently enacted. And the preliminary plan was submitted on July 11th, within 6 months of the preliminary conference. So everything I said is legally correct, but I got the dates fouled up, and I apologize.
I just have one clarification. You say they were effective back to the day they were introduced, but Mr. Shannon tells us the ones that were introduced were withdrawn. Is that a correct characterization, or were they amended, or how do we get back to that date if what he tells us is true?
He was correct in that the first ordinance, which preceded all of these, there was one single APFO, and it was introduced in November of 05. It was subsequently withdrawn. It was that ordinance to which he was referring. But the ordinance that has effect or not, depending on the outcome of this case, was one of the ordinances introduced in June of 06, and enacted in March of 07.
That would be June 12th, 06. That's what
June 13th, sir. Your Honor, our view is that the law in effect at the time of the preliminary conference not the time of the preliminary application, but the time of the preliminary conference is the law on which the applicant is entitled to rely if he or she moves to the next step, which is the application for preliminary plan approval within 6 months. That's relevant here because the intervening law change, given the retroactivity of these ordinances, occurred in the middle. Preliminary conference, introduction of new ordinances, and the effective date of the new ordinances, and then the preliminary plan, which was filed within 6 months. And so 187.17d, we think clearly, gives this applicant the comfort of knowing that changes which intervened between his preliminary conference and his application, timely application for a preliminary plan approval, do not apply to this project. Thank you, Your Honors.
Unless is it correct that 187.17 is unique to Kent County?
Yes, sir.
So I appreciate your clarification. And so what another way of saying it is, if the law that applies to you is the one at the preliminary conference, even though you couldn't have been clairvoyant and know that an ordinance would subsequently be introduced that would be retroactive to within a couple of weeks of your preliminary plan application, you're still okay because the way the statute or ordinance is written that you rely on, it says you only have to comply with the law at the time of the preliminary conference if you get your application in within 6 months. And it's only if you don't get it in within 6 months that you need to be concerned about any changes in the law, even if they came about through some retroactive application.
Your Honor has it exactly. Please hold that thought. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take this matter under consideration, and we'll also have a brief recess.